Well, hi. How you doing? Good. Can you hear me? I feel like these microphones are talking to my belly button right now. Is the level okay in the back? Okay. All right. Just checking. Wow. It's kind of disconcerting. Anyway, appreciated that piano music. That was very, very nice. I could listen to that all day, tell you the truth. So, very nice. Very much appreciate that. It's good to see you all here today in this nice hall, nice auditorium. And we're very happy that we can all meet together. It's nice to have kind of a fuller crowd out there. And so we all look forward to lunch today. All right, let me make sure my slides are working. Great. Perfect. All right, today I want to talk about a topic of being a weapon of righteousness. Now, when you read the title, you may think of this differently in the sense of maybe I'm going to talk about, you know, putting on or using weapons of God. But what I actually want to talk about today is you and I being a weapon of righteousness or being a weapon of unrighteousness. And let me explain what I mean by that. I'm going to have to back up a little bit because there's a lesson that we can pull out of the days of unleavened bread that I think we possibly miss a lot of times. When we look at these days, I think we tend to sometimes just look at it in what I would call a defensive position, in the sense that we think that the days or this week is just about putting out sin, that we are to put out sin. But if you actually look at the title of the holy days that we're in the middle of right now, it's called the days of unleavened bread. And I won't turn there, but back in Exodus, God said, "You shall eat unleavened bread for 7 days." In other words, there is something, yes, they put out leavening, but it's not 7 days of putting out leavening. It's actually 7 days of eating unleavened bread. So in other words, there is a two-sided thing that is done here. One is putting out the sin, and the other is eating something or doing something that's more putting things inside of you. Now, if we focus in that side of it, I'd like to focus more on today and kind of draw two conclusions out of that. And there's a couple important lessons that are in here, because I think one is a picture, if we just emphasize that you just put out sin, ends up being a picture that, like again I say, is a defensive position, that it's you against sin, and you struggle daily, weekly, every hour, and that's what your entire life consists of, is just you and the struggle against sin directly. Now, let's turn over to 2 Peter 2, verse 18. 2 Peter 2, verse 18. And let's start to dig into this concept, and it'll take a few scriptures for me to develop this. But here is the start of a conversation, 2 Peter 2, verse 18 and 19. This is using the language of these days, the days of the Passover, the days of unleavened bread, the days of ancient Israel coming out of bondage and out of Egypt, and you'll see this scattered throughout. Now it's talking about people who have crept in. Peter says here, "For when they speak great swelling words of emptiness, they allure through the lusts of the flesh, through lewdness, the ones who have actually escaped from those who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are slaves of corruption. For by whom a person is overcome, by him he is brought into bondage." So what we find here is the start of a lot of the language. Now, there's a few key concepts that are brought out here and a number of other scriptures that I will read as we go forward that use the same type of language and talk about how it affects a person and how you overcome this and what it means to be in bondage, what it means to be free, and then how you actually achieve that. Now, the first concept that's being introduced here is what's called lust of the flesh. And we're going to explore that in the next couple slides a little bit more in depth. But if you look at lust of the flesh as a concept, a lot of times this would be equated to what we call sin. There are lusts that are in our flesh that when we act on them, that result in us sinning. And we'll kind of explore that a little bit deeper. And what I'd like for us to understand is the part that sin or that plays in your life in becoming a weapon of unrighteousness. Now, the opposite's going to be true. By putting out the sin and fulfilling what these days picture, you become a weapon of righteousness. And exactly how does that work? Because A lot of times I believe that we're probably a mixture of the two or never quite made up our minds, drifting back and forth. And what I like to explain today clearly is to show you how you move from one to the other and what part sin plays in that. And understanding that we are to eat unleavened bread every day of these weeks helps us to kind of break through and figure out what that means. Now, there's other things that are mentioned here. As ancient Israel was in bondage in Egypt, they were slaves. And so the same language is being used here by Peter to say that you are slaves if you are overcome by corruption or by the sin. Or if this lust of the flesh is presented to you, you succumb to that, then you become a slave, you are overcome by that, you are now in what is called bondage. And what they're saying is that people will offer that out to you as freedom. There is a contradiction there, where people offer freedom with these great swelling speeches and words and say, look, you know, man, this feels good. I've never been happier than I've ever been in my entire life. What they're describing is that they're actually introducing you back into bondage. Now, which one of those you are overcome with is how you'll be brought into bondage? You can be overcome by the lust of the flesh, or you can be overcome, or you can overcome the lust of the flesh. And as we know, Christ said, I overcame the world. So let's kind of break this down. This introduces the concepts in these days. Let's start by exploring the concept of the lust of the flesh. Now, why is it important to understand or to go through this? Now, basically, when you look at the lust of the flesh or the things that are going to pull on you in this world, the Bible lists three main things, or three main pulls or lusts of the flesh. Let's turn over to 1 John 2:16, and it defines these three things there. These are things that are in the world, things that are going to pull on you. It says, for all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the same term again, it's the lust of the eyes and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. A lot of times they'll read straight over that scripture and say, okay, yeah, that makes sense. But you know what? This is very specifically calling out three separate things, and these are distinct things. Lust of the flesh, if you think about it, are those things that are in our bodies, such as, you know, a lot of times we'll think about this only in the terms of maybe sex or a sex drive, as in lust. But lust of the flesh includes a lot of other things that are natural proclivities that our flesh wants to gravitate towards. That includes things like getting angry, you know, yelling at people, includes sexual things, and includes all of those kind of desires and those pulls would be grouped under the term lust of the flesh. So it says this world, this is part of the world, and this is one of the ways the world is going to pull on you is through the lust of the flesh. True or not? True or not, everything you see on television or every single movie that you see is about either sex or revenge. Think about revenge movies. That is a huge pull of the flesh. Somebody who's been done wrong, and they've had enough, and I ain't taking it no more, and they come back and kind of blow away everybody. Right? It feels good, doesn't it? Right? The whole motive of a revenge movie is describing perfectly a lust of the flesh. That's what it's saying. One of the things that the world offers out to you is the lust of the flesh. Another thing it describes as a lust of the eyes. This is a different term, not the same thing. This is more around the idea of what you see or what you want to have. Like your eyes look and they lust after things. So this could, you know, in the way it manifests itself in this world, is via, you know, acquiring things. This is acquiring, you know, cars and houses and a bigger car and a bigger house and more around physical things that you just desire to see and to have and to want physical things. So we have pulls of the flesh, we have things that are going to appeal to your eyes, and then the third thing is what's called the pride of life. A third pillar of what the world is going to pull at you on is the pride of life. Well, what does that mean? That means basically your position in life, your place, you know, versus others, if you think of it that way. You know, what is everyone's goal in life is to, you know, a lot of people just want to have power or to have a position, right, so that they can be over other people. You know what, in this, you may think of this only in the context of corporations and people being in charge, but you know what, I've been to bake sales at the local school where, you know, there's one person who has to just throw their weight around and let everyone know that they're in charge of that bake sale table. So it is a tendency of human nature that is not just in a corporate world, but it is top to bottom that people want to have a position and a status that's over other people, and it manifests itself in the way of control as well. People want to control other people all the time. So what 1 John 2:16 is bringing up three very important things is that these three things are what the world is going to offer to you. And you know what? This is how the world seduces people. This is how people are taken out of the church. How many times do people just completely leave the church over a doctrinal element? Maybe. But they tend to just break off into different factions. Where are people pulled completely out of the church so they want to have nothing to do with it anymore and could care less? That is when these things pull on people and they succumb to them so that the church means nothing to them anymore. I now have a big position, power. I don't care if I'm working on Saturday, it doesn't matter. I now have arrived. Or, you know, maybe it's the appeal of some certain lust or drugs or other things that just take you completely out. What this is saying is very important around this week is that these are the things that the world offers you to seduce you. It will seduce you this way. True or not? There's another example in the Bible, Genesis 3:16. So this is one that we've read over and over and over again. But this is back in the Garden of Eden, where we have the two trees that were presented to man, to Adam and Eve. Now, what we'll notice here is a lot of times we'll just read right over this scripture as well, Genesis 3:16. But you know what? It's saying the exact same three things are listed here. It says, so when the woman saw that the tree was what? It was three things. It was good for food. Right? Good for food. Desire, like, you know, I just desiring that apple or whatever it is, that piece of chocolate, it's a lust of the flesh. It was pleasant to the eyes. Right? The lust of the eyes. It was something that appealed to the eyes as well. And what? The third thing, desirable to make one wise. Okay, so the New Testament introduces there's three things that the world offers to seduce you. And guess what? These are all the way back in Genesis, just phrased a different way. Presented to Eve to seduce her. Did it work? It worked. Does it work every time? It works every time. Especially if you're not aware of it. It'll work every time. So what we find is the New Testament and the Old Testament are describing three of the same things about this world, and they agree together that the way it's going to present itself to you and the way it's going to pull on you and it's going to try to seduce you to go its way. The Bible also lists in another place, let's turn to Jude verse 11. Jude verse 11 gives out three examples. And again, we've always just read right over this. But if you dig just a tiny bit deeper, you will find that these three examples would line up exactly with each one of these three things that are described in 1 John. So it says, woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain, they've run greedily in the ear of Balaam for profit, and they've perished in the rebellion of Korah. Three examples of pitfalls that people have gone towards that exactly mirror these three different ways. Let me bring up another slide to kind of put these side by side. And you can see the formula that's laid down and that's in place here. The lust of the flesh in John is the same thing as what's termed good for food in Genesis. And the example that's given there is Cain. Now it's important that Cain's an example because, again, it helps us shed light on that. When it talks about the lust of the flesh, it's not just talking about like a sexual sin. It's also talking about those other natural proclivities, because what happened to Cain is he got angry. He got angry, and he gave into that anger to the extent that he killed his brother. And you can start to see a pattern here, that he became what is called a tool or a weapon of unrighteousness. And hold that thought. There's a direct relationship as we weave through this between the sin and what the world pulls on you, giving into that and becoming a weapon of unrighteousness. And you can see Cain gave into his pull, that flesh, that anger. Now, lust of the eyes, if you remember the story of Balaam, he was offered a big sum of money if he would go curse Israel. That is just was too overwhelming for him. What he saw with his eyes that he could have, what he saw out of that he could get, was just too much of a pull for him, that he also became a weapon of unrighteousness and went. And, you know, you remember the story with there. But that draw there for him was money or the lust of the eyes. And the last one is Korah. If you remember the example of Korah, as far as with Moses, Korah thought, you know what? I've got way more talents than this guy does. You know, God's given me way more abilities. I could do a better job. I could do way more than this. This person's, you know, getting old. Not in tune with the young people, or whatever line of reasoning there was that was behind that. Korah said that, you know what, I should be in that position. I should be the one, because I am way more talented than Moses here, should be there. The pride of life took him over, and as, you know, Genesis says, the desire to make one wise, Korah made a stand for power. Overwhelmed him, pulled him, and what did he become? A weapon of unrighteousness again, for not only himself, but his family and those people that he swindled into that. So a whole group of people ended up dying because of that. Now there is a direct relationship here, and there's a formula, as I put on here, that is at play here over and over and over again. Now let's ask a question that's very important to ask. If you go back to the Genesis example, what is it that made Eve cave in? What is it that made her give up? What is it that took her out of her relationship with God? Well, notice, first off, is that her first intellectual response was correct, wasn't it? Right? When she was presented with this, she said the right thing. She had the right knowledge inside of her head. She said, look, and not only that, she's quoting Scripture. She says, God said that we may eat of all the trees except for this tree over here. I'm quoting back what God said. The right place to start and right place to live. Right? But what happened here? It wasn't that intellectual response was the thing that did it. The emotional, the physical, the sensual pull was just way too great. It was way too great on her. The lust of the flesh, that was desirable to make one wise, it was pleasant to the eyes, all of these things assaulted her senses that pulled her away. It was that took her down as well as Adam. It was that was the very thing that got to her. It was not the intellectual response. Why is this important? It's important for a number of reasons. I like to bring out one. Because this world pulls on us, and a lot of times we kind of just dismiss it. Or we think that, you know, I've been sitting in the church my whole life, and I know the Sabbath day, and I know the holy days. And there's a lot of second and third generation Christians out there. I happen to be a third generation Christian. There's a lot out there that have a lot of knowledge in their heads and could tell you the right biblical response, couldn't you? You could say, well, God says to do this. But that is not what gets people hooked in this world and takes them out. There is a pull. There is a lust that is in our flesh that causes us to act even irrationally a lot of times and go do things that we wouldn't want to normally do. So this manifests itself, like I say, you know, to us as Christians a lot of different ways. You know, it could be the appeal or the lust of the flesh. It could be that it is, you know, a girl or sex or something overtakes you. It could be the lust of the eyes where, you know what, you're starting to make headway in a career and the more you work and the more hours you put in, the more successful you become. You start moving up that ladder and the next step is, you know, we want to put you over this. We also want you to fly and maybe work on some Saturdays. It's not every Saturday at first, is it? Well, maybe I, you know, worked into the Sabbath a little bit, and then it just kind of starts to creep in. And what happened is that pull of what you could have and that money that you could have starts to overwhelm that other thing until you don't care about God's way anymore. And the pride of life as well. You know, the allure of success and being something in this world is quite strong. You know, athletics does this to you. Look at professional athletes. Look at actors, actresses. Look at musicians. There is such a pull to be something in this world that that looks incredibly appealing. It looks completely appealing. And those are the things that will pull on you. And this is what, the reason I bring this up is, well, understand that this plays a huge part, as we saw before, in you becoming a weapon of unrighteousness or becoming a weapon of righteousness. And there is a way, I don't want this to sound completely fatalistic, because we'll understand, the Bible describes a way and a methodology for dealing with this effectively. But I think when we just look at the days of unleavened bread, to go back to the beginning and say, it's just about me putting out sin, and I'm just struggling with that lust of the flesh, if that's where you stop, they will overwhelm you. The days of unleavened bread talk about eating unleavened bread and putting on something that deals with that effectively. There is a huge difference in what I just said there, which I'll explain a little bit more as we go. Now, Paul describes this in Romans 7, verse 18, and addresses this condition for us. Romans 7, verse 18. He says, "For I know that in me, that is in my flesh," again, he's talking about the poles and those things that are in the flesh, "nothing good dwells. For to will is present with me, but how to perform what is good I do not find. For good that I will to do, I do not do. But the evil that I will not to do, that I practice." And he goes on to say the famous phrase, "Oh, wretched man that I am." Just as a side note, I remember back in college, I had a best friend who was Australian, and he would go into, this was at AC College, he would go into a prayer closet, and he'd crack the door open a little bit, and he would just say at the top of his lungs, "Oh, wretched man that I am," so that the whole hall could hear him. It was just a little joke. I thought that was funny. Typical Australian. But what Paul is describing here is this very struggle, isn't he? Now, we can stop with this set of scriptures, can't we, and say, that's my condition. I agree. I like Paul. Makes me feel better. Right? And oh, wretched man that I am. It's the way it is. We could stop there. But you know what? Paul also wrote other things in the Bible, because this is one part of how Paul addresses this. He addresses the same topic 100 different ways in other scriptures. So if you stop here, your growth can stop, your putting out sin can stop, and your view of yourself can be stuck in that, it's the way it is. It's the way it is. So there is a battle that's described here, and what Paul is just describing is the battle. He's saying that, you know what, these poles that I just showed you, lust of the flesh, lust of the eyes, and the pride of life, are constant pulls. And if you know Paul, Paul had a lot of things in life that he had done. He had a lot of background, training, education, that he was somebody before he became an apostle, destitute, shipwrecked, sleepless, hungry, everything else. And I'm sure a lot of that at times could pull on him to be seen as something again. I'm reading into this, but I'm just saying that he understood this battle very much. He understood that the pulls that could be there, and he says that, boy, these things just keep raising their ugly heads up that I have to do battle with at all times. And as you know, he was given a thorn in the flesh. He had a lot of trials that he went through so that he would not become, like I said, for the abundance of revelation. He was given a lot of knowledge directly by God, and God also gave him a lot of different trials and tests so that he would not succumb to these other things. Right? Paul understood this concept very clearly. And what I'd like to cover in some of the next scriptures are also some of the other things that Paul said on how you specifically deal with these things. First, there's some failed strategies for dealing with these things. I think there's a lot of natural ways we want to approach the pulls of the flesh and what the world offers us that don't work. One of the first strategies, or failed strategies, is failed strategy number one. And what I call this strategy is the blank screen strategy for now. What I call this strategy is becoming a monk. Now, I don't mean this in any disrespect to people, but what I mean by this is the idea that, you know what, there's all of these pulls, and there's all these lusts of the world, and all these things coming at me, that I'm going to go hole up and completely separate myself from them. I'm going to stay in my house. I'm not going to talk to my neighbors. I'm not going to go to work. I'm going to work from home. I'm going to keep my kids out of school. I'm going to hole up in what would become like a monk's lifestyle. A monk denies every single possible thing where they end up in, you know, sitting there and just kind of meditating all day and those type of things where they're not ever really encountering the outside world. Now, this is a failed strategy for a number of reasons. One, if you think about this, when you start to withdraw, and the only people you say you're going to associate yourself with, a lot of times are, you'll come to church. I'll come to church. But when you have this mentality, what happens when you come to church? Because you're going to encounter some people that may be angry at you, that may be going through sins and things. And so you come to church and you say, there's that world is here. I'm going to stop talking to that person. And that person talked to that person. I'm going to stop talking. And this pretty soon, you end up with a group of maybe two or three people that you end up hanging out with. Because you now have separated yourself and made yourself a monk, even when you come to church. Now, this is a failed strategy for a number of reasons. I'll just bring out one that is mentioned over in Colossians 2. You turn to Colossians 2, verse 20. Colossians 2, verse 20 says, therefore, if you died with Christ from the basic principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, you subject yourself to regulations? Now, this is talking about, for example, the lifestyle of a monk, a regulation of do not touch, do not taste, do not handle, which all concern things which perish with the using, according to the commandments and doctrines of men. So it's a fleshly strategy to deal with these things. You even read about this in Benjamin Franklin's autobiography, right? He was really trying hard to overcome certain, you know, human characteristics, and he found when he overcame one, another would pop up, and you know, this type of thing. There's a similar concept here. It says, these things indeed have an appearance of wisdom and a self-imposed religion, false humility, and neglect of the body, you know, punishing yourself, not eating, you know, just for that, but are of no value against the indulgence of the flesh. So, this is a failed strategy because if you are not facing up to the pulls of this world, and where these pulls really take place are inside of you, aren't they? So if you're holed up like a monk so you can escape the outside world, and that's where you think the problem is, you will succumb to the flesh as soon as you're given a chance. You will be overwhelmed. Because what we have to find and start to realize that it's not just out there. The way you deal with it is inside of you, is where you address it. So as this says, just kind of leading a life where you close the door and have nothing around you is not of value to the indulgence of the flesh. Now please hear me correctly. I'm not saying, well, just go on out there and indulge all you want. That is not what I'm saying. I'm saying the approach where you are just holed up and you cut yourself off from anybody and everybody so you never encounter it. Because what we're going to talk about is encountering it and overcoming it. There's a difference. If you never face it, you're never going to overcome it. What's failed strategy number two? Failed strategy number two is what I like to call just keeping busy. In other words, you know what? I don't like what I see. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to fill up every second of every day with doing something. You know what? I don't have to think about it. And you know what? I'm not sinning because I'm, and especially, let me put this in a correct way, this can become a problem in the church if your idea to avoid facing these things is just to serve and set up chairs and do everything else. In some ways, you can think you're doing God's will, and in fact, you're just ignoring what's going on. I'm not saying do not help, do not set up. Please hear that correctly. I'm saying that if you are doing the activities so you can ignore what's going on underneath, that is a failed strategy. Keeping yourself busy so you don't have to face it just postpones it, because it will come out. And unless it's directly addressed, you won't overcome it. And you can see this listed in a number of different scriptures in the Bible. One of those is Mark 4:19. Mark 4:19. In fact, the opposite happens. You're not just ignoring what's going on in you. It says the cares of this world, the deceitfulness of riches, and the desires for other things. And enter in and choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. When you allow yourself to become so busy that you don't want to face it, you're not just not facing those things, you are not allowing the word to take root in your life and to grow. That word is being choked out. And let me ask you today, out of this parable that's mentioned here, which I didn't read the entire one, do you agree that that is not the most prevalent thing that could happen to you today? And what I mean by that, does the world not offer you 2,593 things to do today? Television, the internet, Xbox, PSP, more internet, telephones, talking with people, going to the movies. Are there not 1,000 things that you could occupy your day and still not get 1/10 of them done? This world offers you easy access to choke out and ignore the bad. It's twofold, isn't it? Because if I can keep myself occupied, I can ignore all that bad stuff. But you know what's also happening? It's a double-edged sword. Because I am choking out the word, it is not taking root in my life. The taking root in your life is what I'm here to talk about today. How you overcome that. So this is failed strategy number two. That is just keeping busy. Just keeping busy so you don't have to think about it. Failed strategy number three. This one I call the oh wretched man that I am strategy. This is just tossing in the flag. I am a wretched man. I am a wretched woman. I see that. I don't like it. There's nothing I can do about it, so I am waving the white flag of surrender. I just give up. You know, I pray to God and ask Him to forgive me every day, but I have given up because that is the way I am built. Paul said it. Paul's my favorite. I love that scripture. I'm a wretched man. That's where you stop. But you don't read the rest of what Paul said. You don't read the rest of what's in the New Testament, because there's a number of scriptures that are put out for us. 1 John 4, verse 4 is one of those. It says, "You are children of God, little children, and have overcome them." There's different language here. "Because He who is in you is greater than he who is in the world." And all that is pulling on you in the world, there is something greater that is in you than all of those things pulling on you. So if you stop with, "Oh, wretched man that I am," and say, "That's the way it is, and I'm going to sin," you are missing the term here that's called overcome. And 1 John 5:4 says, "For whatever is born of God overcomes the world." And what does John tell us is in the world? Is those three things. Christ said, "Be of good cheer. I have overcome the world." So I think sometimes we could set our sights a little too low, and you will hit that lower mark. But the Bible talks about that it can be overcome, and the power that is in you is stronger than that power that is in the world. Okay, so first it's very important to identify the world and how it's going to pull on you and how you succumb to it. Otherwise, it will just blindside you and flip you upside down and you won't know what happened. Two, it's important to understand some strategies that don't work. Separating yourself completely. Just being too busy. Or just throwing up your hands. Are all things that will not get you there. So what is it that does work, though? What is it does work, and how does this relate to my topic of the day, you're probably wondering as well. Let's go through the term weapons of righteousness. And where is that found? Let's turn over to Romans 6. Romans 6 and verse 13 is where I get this from. Romans 6 and verse 13. Now, it's going to recap exactly what we've been talking about. The same language, the same terms, the same things. And it's going to add a dimension to what we've been saying. It says, therefore, do not let sin reign in your mortal body, that you should obey its lusts. Same verbiage that we've been talking about. Again, the world's going to pull at you through certain lusts. And this is saying, do not let those things reign in your body, take over, rule, dominate, enslave you, capture you. The same language is taking place here. It says, do not present yourselves members, or present your members as instruments of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members as instruments of righteousness to God. For sin shall not have dominion over you, for you're not under the law, but under grace. Verse 13 talks about two different types of instruments. And if you look at the Greek for the word instrument that's listed there, it's the word, it really means weapons. So when it's talking about instruments, like it would be used in the term weapons of war. How do I know that? Because if you look at how that word is translated in four other locations in the New Testament, in John 18, I won't turn to all these, they're just on the screen, they came with lanterns and torches and weapons to arrest Christ. Romans says, let's put on the armor. So we have weapons and armor. And then 2 Corinthians 6 says, by the power of God, by the armor of righteousness. And then 2 Corinthians 10:4 says, do not war after the flesh, for the weapons of our warfare, or the instruments of our warfare, are not carnal. So the word instrument, if you translate it, means weapons. Weapons is the whole thing that you are. It includes the armor, it includes the swords, it is all that you do battle with. It is everything that you do battle with, is the weapons or the instruments. What does 13 say again? Do not present your members as weapons of unrighteousness to sin. It's not by accident that the word is weapons, instrument weapons. Why is it not by accident? Because I think a lot of times we think, when I have a sin, you know what? I'm struggling with that myself. You know what? And I'm not going to let anybody know. I'm over here. I'm not affecting anybody. I just have to deal with that during the week. Now, what happens is that is not the case. When it says these things reign or in your mortal bodies, you become a weapon of unrighteousness to sin. And a weapon is something that is used to attack other people. Is this true or not? When we went through the examples that I was describing before, we have Cain. Was he who had this anger, which he could have on his own, or I'm just venting on the side over here, did he not become a weapon against somebody else? Why don't you ask Abel that? He became a huge weapon. Same with Balaam against Israel. Same with Korah. When you let sin reign in your mortal body, it is not just about you. So when we come to these days of unleavened bread, and we talk about putting out sin, and we consider it a personal struggle, it's true, but you must start to think about it that you, depends on which way you go, you can become a weapon of unrighteousness that slashes and hurts other people as well. Or, the opposite is put forth here as well, but present yourselves being alive from the dead and your members as instruments of righteousness. So the opposite can happen. The opposite can happen here as well. Now, let's look at a couple more scriptures. Proverbs 25:28. Proverbs 25:28 sheds some light on why this is the case. Same verbiage is mentioned here. You know, if you're talking about weapons in warfare, people attack cities or castles and they take them down. This says, whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. If you give in to just those things all the time, your outbursts, your lust, all those things, it's as if you are a city that has no defenses. you have no walls. You can easily be captured. You can easily be manipulated. Now, take that thought a step further. 2 Timothy 2:22 carries on the same concept. 2 Timothy 2, verse 22 says, "Flee also youthful lust, but pursue righteousness, faith, love, peace, with those who call on the Lord out of a pure heart, in humility correcting those who are in opposition, if God perhaps will grant them repentance, so that they may know the truth, and that they may come to their senses and escape the snare." They've been trapped. They've been captured. Their city had no walls. They're down. "Having been taken captive by him to do his will." If you think it's just about you as well, another important part to understand about these days is that we are not wrestling against flesh and blood. That when you allow yourself to have these open tendencies or to have these sins reign in your body, you are easily manipulated by Satan himself. People are captured. They're like a city without a wall, no defenses, and can be used and manipulated to do his will. And you know what? The people usually don't even know it. You don't even know it. A lot of times when you're striking out at somebody, you maybe feel like you feel better, or you're venting, or it's part of a natural thing, but you don't really understand what is taking place here because we're not viewing it with on a spiritual level. That you can be captured and people can be used to hurt and to harm other people. So if we think about this, we can become weapons of unrighteousness. And think of it like a picture of a marionette. If you do not have control and you let that stuff reign in your mortal body and Satan captures people at will, you're like a marionette that can just be used to kind of walk over here and do something to somebody else. And this is the place, and this is the way that we become those weapons of unrighteousness. So it's not about just us, right? It's not about, and if you think about it, what your mind goes through a lot of times is you say, well, you know, I do have a lot of anger, but you don't know how I grow up. You know, I have a lot of issues. I have a lot of things that I had to deal with, and so these outbursts against other people, you know what, that's part of me venting and feeling better. You know what? You know, people say, you just misunderstand me. I don't understand me. You know what? It's you that doesn't understand that very thing that you're saying is a natural thing is what the Bible describes as one of the works of the flesh. Those anger, those outbursts, those things that are natural. And if you're in a mindset where you think that, well, that's a natural part because of my history, because of this, or because of something else, you are the one who does not understand that you are in bondage to that, that you are enslaved to that you are manipulated at will. Have you ever seen this? I see this all the time with people, even at work. You know, before preparing this sermon, the past couple days got really, really funny at work. Not funny, as in ha-ha, but funny as in painful. I don't know why I use the word funny, but... You know, things that came out of nowhere, people got angry, things blew up, all of this while trying to prepare this. And I just thought, you know what? There's some tendency I know these people have. They don't see it. They don't control it. They don't try to. And they, at that time, get to be a little marionette and a little pawn. Has that happened to you? Have you seen somebody where that happens, where they have a vulnerability and they just get manipulated at will? Satan will use those people. What I'm here to say is to not look at other people, but to look at yourself. When you let that sin reign in your mortal body, you can become a weapon of unrighteousness and slash everyone around you. Let me just put it that way. That can be what happens here. So therefore, when we talk about putting out sin, this is not just about you off in the, you know, somewhere and dealing with it on your own. There's a dynamic here that's spiritual, that it is in regard to the body. And for us to put away a lot of the sins that we have towards each other, it starts inside of us. You must put away those things that are inside of you if we're going to stop biting and devouring each other. What does it say in Galatians 5:13? Galatians 5:13 says, "For you, brethren, have been called to liberty." Same language. "Only do not use liberty as an opportunity for the flesh." Same language. "But through love, serve one another. For all the law is fulfilled in one word, even this: you shall love your neighbor as yourself. But if you bite and devour one another, beware lest you can be consumed by one another." It's exactly what it's saying. Letting the flesh run rampant, you become somebody who bites, devours, and consumes other people. So, for us as a body, to start to root out sin, it must start with us. There's a direct relationship of giving into those lusts, harboring them in secret, not dealing with them, and how you will be a tool against other people or a tool for other people. It is very, very clearly spoken of in the Bible. So, what do we do? What do we do? Galatians 5:16, very simple verse, says an entire mouthful. "I say then, who's I? Paul, O wretched man that I am." Okay? Part two of that thought that he started over in Romans is right here. "I say then, walk in the Spirit, and you shall not fulfill the lust of the flesh. Do this, and you won't fulfill those things." Very simple statement. This does not say, by the way, you just sit there and resist. Now, hear that correctly, because you do resist sin. I'm just saying it's not in what I call a defensive posture, where you just say, "Oh, I'm doing battle. This says something else. This says walk. Forward movement. Forward movement. Different. This is not just I'm sitting there defensively. I am walking. Walk. Move. Forward. A whole different idea is introduced here. That's why I said in the beginning, if we look at this Days of Unleavened Bread and just say, "I just put out sin," it's not what it says. You eat unleavened bread every day. You put in Christ. You walk something. There's a huge key that's brought out in these days that is explained right here. The only way that you're going to put away those pulls of the flesh is if you walk forward. You walk in the Spirit. Now, what does this mean? I like to describe that, you know, basically there's kind of three stances you can be in. Three different stances. One stance is you are fulfilling the lust of the flesh. The direction that you are going is backwards, if you want to add a direction to it. And the fruits that you are bearing are things like adultery, fornication, uncleanness, all of the works of the flesh, outbursts of wrath, things like that. That is when you are fulfilling the lust of the flesh. You are going that direction. And you become a tool. There's another stance. This is what I call the defensive position. And I think it's important to call this out. And what I mean by that is, you're not yet walking. You're just struggling. Sometimes you're fulfilling the lust, sometimes you're not. Sometimes you hate it, sometimes you don't. You're back and forth. You're just kind of sitting in the middle there, dipping in and out of that, in a defensive position. What direction are you going? Absolutely nowhere. You're in limbo. One direction is purely backwards. Another direction is in limbo. Now, to contrast that, what we just read is walking is not the same as those two. Walking is forward movement. This is the area of growth. This is the area of movement. This is the area that produces things like love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness. Can you sit in that middle, in limbo land, struggling, and produce any of those things? I would position to you that you can't, that you're too wrapped up in just what's in front of your eyes and the struggle, and you're happy and you're sad and this and that, that you're going to be a roller coaster all day long, all week long. There is only one thing that Galatians points out. There's only one of these stances that says when you live in this stance, you will not fulfill the other one. And that is if you walk in the Spirit, it says that you will not fulfill those lusts of the flesh. If it is forward movement and growth, then you won't fulfill those other things. Now, you can look at this purely physically, but you know what? Walking in the Spirit is the realm where spiritual dynamics happen that you can't explain. There are things that take place that normally wouldn't take place because you are of the Spirit, in the Spirit, and God's power is at play here. So when you get to the place where you're walking in the Spirit, the power of God comes with that walk. The one in the middle, the defensive, is more you, half on your power, half on God's power, up, down, up, down. The reason I keep saying that is I'd like to propose that maybe think about it. It may not be true, but maybe we spend more of our times in the limbo middle position than we do forward moving position. And that is why we're in and out of fulfilling the lust of the flesh or not. There's only one position or stance to be in, that's walking forward in the Spirit. And that is distinct from these other two. That middle position will not get you there. Let's look at two examples to wrap this up. The first example is the Corinthians. So the Corinthians, this is what was happening around the Passover time, Passover season. 1 Corinthians 11:17 says, "Now in giving you these instructions, I do not praise you, since you come together not for the better but for the worse. For in eating, each one of you takes his own supper ahead of others, and one is hungry and another is drunk. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason, many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep." We read this all the time around Passover. Passover, the beginning of the days of unleavened bread. But what was happening here? Name for me, not out loud, which of the pulls of this world or pulls they were giving into here? Which of the three can you think of? One's very obvious. There's a couple that are obvious. Were they giving into the pride of life? That's a huge thing here. When they came together, it was, I have more than you. I'm going to separate myself on this table. I'm going to, you know, you're not eating. I am superior. That's one thing. They gave into that. Another thing, the lust of the flesh. Some got drunk. They were just making it into a party. They were letting that reign in their mortal bodies, giving into that. Right? And all three of them could be at play here, but you can start to see that they were giving into those pulls and those lusts at the very Passover, and they were not discerning the Lord's body. They were not recognizing what, when they take those symbols, who Christ died for was all the people around them and their relationship to the people around them. They saw it as about me and what I have. And you know what happened? They became instruments of unrighteousness here, condemning other people. And not only that, as a group, judgment was brought upon them. They became an instrument of destruction. Why? Because many were sick and died. On a spiritual level, when you fulfill those things, you may think all is well with you and it's just about you, but the body was judged and people were dying. They became instruments of unrighteousness, weapons that literally were killing other people. If they discerned the Lord's body and who it was, they would be praying for those people who are sick. Sometimes we read that and say the people who died were the ones who were sinning. That's not necessarily the case. I'd also like us to think that maybe God put the judgment on the body, that if they were not thinking about themselves and thinking about the others around them, maybe they could have been praying and interceding for each other, and maybe some of them could not have died. But their minds were on themselves and their position, so that people died when they should have lived. They, all around, start to finish, became a weapon of unrighteousness. A very clear example is given here that happened around this time. Now, the opposite's true as well. Let's give an example of walking in the Spirit. There's a very clear example in Romans 12:17. It describes what it means to walk in the Spirit. It says, "Repay no one for evil for evil." Okay? So you start with somebody is doing evil to you, your natural pull of the flesh is to strike back at them, isn't it? It says, first off, do not repay evil for evil. Have regard for good things in the sight of all men. If it's possible, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, Do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath. Let it slide, for it's written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. Therefore, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. For in so doing, you'll heap coals of fire on his head. Now, this is different. This is not on physical terms. This is on spiritual terms, and this is where spiritual miracles start to happen. When you walk in the Spirit, it's not just saying, okay, that person did evil to me, I'm biting my tongue. That is a start. That's a good start. But to walk, like I said, is forward movement. You're going somewhere, you're doing something. Here, it says, do not avenge yourselves, you let God do that. Two, you do something that walks in God's way. Here, if your enemy's hungry, you feed him. If he's thirsty, you give him a drink. You go above and beyond and you be kind. That is a forward movement walk. If you're faced with a situation, think about it in your own life, a lot of times when you're presented with anger or evil or people doing things to you, we bite our tongues and we stuff it down and, you know, we've done our thing, but it stews. That is middle limbo land. You stop there. You're struggling with it. You stop. Until you walk forward, it won't be overcome. Until you move forward, it won't be overcome. What happens? Miracles happen. Spiritual miracles happen when you walk in this realm. Why? Do not become overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. That evil can be overcome only if you walk. Is that with the other person? Yes. But you know what? More importantly, that statement is also referring to you. If you stay in limbo land and you struggle with it, you're going to implode after a while. If you walk forward, there's a miracle that takes place that evil that would normally be inside of you, harbored, the anger and those type of things, can be overcome in you when you act this way. So you can walk forward without biting your tongue all the time, without being just under the surface. You can have that evil overcome inside of you. Sometimes it works with the other person, sometimes it doesn't. But you must think of it that way. When it's overcome, that is overcome inside you. The evil in you is overcome. What that person did to you can be overcome. A perfect example of not just biting your tongue in limbo land, but walking forward in it. Because when you do that, you're asking God to enact His spiritual principles. You're not dealing with it on your fleshly level. God, you take revenge on me. I am going to do good to that person, and I'm asking you for that healing, and that evil that is in me is overcome, and possibly, quite possibly, you may win a friend. That has happened, can happen, not every time, but it's possible. One way only, walking forward, overcomes that. Only that way overcomes that. And to summarize this, let's read back what we read before. Because you have a choice and a lesson to understand in these days. Why you put out sin, because putting out that sin and not letting it reign in our bodies is the key for you to become either a weapon of unrighteousness or for you to become a weapon of righteousness that can be used by God. When I say used by God, that is the realm of where you see growth. 10, 20, 60-fold is only when you walk. If you want to know how to do that, you must walk in that space, and you will figure out how to make that compound, because compounding 60 times what you could do is not about talent. It is about God's Spirit being enacted and spiritual principles being enacted. Walking in the Spirit, forward movement, is how you get there. As Romans 6:13 says, and do not present your members as weapons of unrighteousness to sin, but present yourselves to God as being alive from the dead, and your members as weapons of righteousness to God.